"I love you," the scrap of paper said. "I can't believe it." Several hours earlier, Delon had been the subject of testimony during a trial in a federal courtroom in Brooklyn. Alejandro Bursaco, the former chief executive of Torneos y Competencias, and after his own guilty plea, a government cooperator, told the jury that over a 3-year period he had paid more than $4 million in bribes to Delon and an associate. The bribes, Bursaco explained, were given at a time that Delon was working as a contract attorney for a government initiative called Fútbol para Todos, which in 2009 had acquired broadcast rights to Argentina's top professional soccer leagues. For many years, Torneos had controlled those rights, and the loss of the business had been a terrible blow. The payments, which allowed Torneos to keep a hand in the Argentine league, represented only a tiny sliver of all the bribes that Bursaco had confessed to paying during his roughly 15 years in the sports marketing business. By his own estimate, he'd paid at least $160 million in bribes to some 30 individuals over the years before he was indicted in May 2015. The revelation was shocking, marking the first time the sordid web of secret payments outlined in the Justice Department's case had been linked directly to public officials. Delon's gruesome death came less than 90 minutes after word of Bursaco's testimony had broken in Argentina, where news outlets were following the case avidly. The lawyer's final phone calls were to the other alleged bribe recipient, who later said Delon seemed so agitated that he invited Delon to come over. He never made it. The following morning, Bursaco, looking tired and drawn, broke down in tears in the witness box before the jury had been seated and had to be escorted out in order to regain his composure. The courtroom gallery, packed with lawyers and journalists, buzzed with speculation over what had just happened. Was he upset about the apparent suicide? Was the pressure too much? But outside the courtroom, Bursaco told an FBI agent that one of the defendants had made a threatening gesture at him, moving his hand as if he were cutting his throat, and had made the same slicing motion across his neck while glaring at him the previous day. The defendant, Manuel Berga, had been president of the Peruvian Soccer Federation for a dozen years until the end of 2014, and was charged in the second indictment in the soccer case a year later. He was eventually extradited to the United States, and now stood charged of one count of RICO conspiracy, which carried a maximum sentence of 20 years. The two other defendants, José María Marín, who had been president of Brazil's Soccer Confederation, and Juan Ángel Naput, the Paraguayan former president of CONMEBOL, were also charged with RICO conspiracy, as well as a host of wire fraud and money laundering counts. After an hour, Bursaco returned to court and swiftly made international headlines again with his account of how Torneos, along with Mexican media giant Televisa and Brazilian broadcaster TV Globo, had paid $15 million in bribes to a high-ranking FIFA official in exchange for television rights to the 2026 and 2030 World Cup. Bursaco walked the jury in detail through the mechanics of years' worth of crooked Copa Libertadores and Copa America deals, and explained how he employed phony contracts and overseas shell companies he called vehicles to skim bribes from seemingly legitimate payments. Bursaco was a fantastic witness. Exhaustively prepared by his attorney, a former federal prosecutor named Sean Casey, who had been with him in Italy when he decided to flip, the charismatic Argentine was deadly serious at times and riotously funny at others. As he told the story of his decision to help the prosecution, Bursaco was somber and sympathetic, breaking out once again in tears and leaving the courtroom in total silence. When he was done for the day and the jury marched out of the court, Judge Pamela Chen returned to Manuel Berga's gesture from that morning. The judge, herself a former prosecutor, said she'd viewed a security tape of one of the incidents and thought there was a probable cause to believe that Berga had attempted to tamper with a witness, a serious federal crime. Over the vehement protest of Berga's lawyer, who said he might call for a mistrial, Judge Chen placed the defendant on what she called extreme house arrest, severely limiting whom he could call and cutting off his internet access and email for the remainder of the case. If there had been any concerns that the long-awaited trial in America Soccer investigation would be a dreary and tedious bore, dragging jurors through painfully dull technicalities, they had been forgotten. Twice a government cooperator had wept in the witness box. One of the defendants had, apparently, made death threats in the courtroom. And a lawyer more than 5,000 miles away had taken his own life after his name was mentioned in court. And it was only the third day. Evan Norris walked into courtroom 4F North of the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse the following morning wearing a dark blue overcoat. He sat down in the gallery among the reporters, families of the defendants, and other onlookers, a slightly wistful expression on his face. After more than 5 years leading the case, from its first spark of an idea through two massive indictments, he had walked away in early 2017 and left the Justice Department altogether that August. As happened with most federal prosecutors in New York, the financial pressures of life in an expensive city on a government salary had finally caught up with Norris. He joined the International Investigations Group at white shoe firm Cravath, Swain & Moore, working closely with one of his former supervisors from the Eastern District. In June, he won an award recognizing him as the top assistant United States attorney in the country. And at his farewell party in Brooklyn, Norris pledged to use some of his new corporate salary to buy his first television, which, he said, he'd researched exhaustively. Amanda Hector, who had joined the case early on and worked directly with a number of the most important cooperators, had left the Justice Department the prior December, taking a job as general counsel at a hedge fund. Jared Randall, the young FBI agent who was the first to meet with Blaser, was also gone. Months earlier, he'd been reassigned to the Bureau's Los Angeles field office to work on international corruption investigations. He followed the trial as best he could through news reports. Mike Gata, the seasoned FBI supervisor who first learned about a potential case against FIFA from Christopher Steele back in 2010, had kept in contact with the former British spy. As a result, he'd been the first in American law enforcement to receive Steele's controversial dossier of allegations about attempts by Russia to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election and the candidacy of Donald Trump. In the summer of 2017, Gata returned to New York after more than 3 years posted in Rome, but C-24, the Eurasian crime squad, was no longer his. Approaching retirement, he was given a new squad to supervise instead, and didn't catch the FIFA trial in person. The only remaining prosecutor with considerable time on the case prior to the first indictment, Sam Nitze, was now leading the three-attorney trial team, which also included Keith Edelman and Kristen Mace. A rangy former newspaper reporter who had given up journalism for law, Nitze had been ramping up for the trial since July, and by early autumn he and the other prosecutors were working 7 days a week to prepare. It was a gargantuan job. All trials are hard work, but none of the prosecutors had ever dealt with a case even half as complicated as this one. The sheer volume of evidence, running into millions of pages, and the long list of potential witnesses from around the world requiring exhaustive preparation, was nearly overwhelming. The run-up to trial put a strain on all of their personal lives and left them exhausted even before jury selection began. Of the more than 40 people charged in the case, 24 had pleaded guilty and agreed to cooperate, including, most recently, an Argentine banker who in June confessed to helping Burzacco maintain Swiss accounts where millions of dollars worth of bribes to Julio Grondona were secretly deposited. 15 other defendants had eluded prosecution. Jack Warner and Nicolas Leos, two primary targets of the investigation, had staved off extradition with a series of appeals. Hugo and Mariano Hincas, meanwhile, had managed to beat extradition altogether when, in late 2016, an Argentine judge denied the request on grounds that the Hincases, owners of Full Play, were being investigated for similar crimes in their home country. That criminal probe, which some whispered had been based on evidence supplied by the Hincases themselves, seemed to be going nowhere. Just 2 months later, Mariano Hincas came in second in a national golf tournament, and his smiling picture was printed in the local newspaper. But with just three exceptions, every single defendant who had been successfully brought to America had eventually copped a plea. It was those three men, each of whom had been extradited against his will and insisted on his innocence, who faced trial starting November 13th. As part of various schemes involving bribes offered by sports marketing firms in exchange for soccer rights, prosecutors claimed Manuel Berga had conspired to take $4.4 million, Jose Maria Marin, $6.5 million, and Juan Angel Naput, some $10.5 million. Proving their guilt to a jury of citizens unfamiliar with soccer and even less so with complex racketeering and fraud statutes would test the theories Norris had first developed years earlier, that because of corruption, FIFA and international soccer operated like organized crime syndicates, that the corruption was endemic, that the men running the sport had abused their positions of trust for their own interests, and that they had relied heavily on American institutions to perpetrate their crimes. But it would not be Norris making those arguments. All he could do, sitting in the gallery among the onlookers, was watch. In the petition FIFA filed in federal court seeking restitution of tens of millions of dollars forfeited by defendants convicted in the case, the Swiss nonprofit claimed it was a victim of its own corrupt officials who grossly abused their trust to enrich themselves while causing significant direct and proximate harm to FIFA. The damage done by the defendant's greed, the petition continued, cannot be overstated. Thanks to fleeing sponsors eager to distance themselves from a tarnished organization, as well as titanic legal expenses, FIFA reported net financial losses of $122 million in 2015 and $369 million in 2016, and it projected even wider losses going forward. In March 2017, a seemingly chastened FIFA turned over a 1,300-page internal corruption investigation it had commissioned in the wake of the first takedown to the Swiss Attorney General. 3 months later, it finally published the long-secret Garcia Report into the 2018 and 2022 World Cup bidding, but only after a German news outlet threatened to leak the document. The Swiss Attorney General, meanwhile, had given no sign of being close to resolving its ongoing investigation of Sepp Blatter. It did announce in June 2017 its first conviction related to soccer. The same Argentine banker who pleaded guilty in Brooklyn in June. He agreed to pay a $650,000 fine as punishment for the crimes of document forgery and failure to report suspected money laundering and would face no jail time. France, too, opened its own criminal investigation into possible corruption in the bids for the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. And in May and July of 2017, Spanish police arrested the former president of the ultra-popular Club Barcelona, as well as the sitting president of Spain's National Federation, as part of separate investigations involving allegations of money being skimmed from friendly matches played by the Brazilian and Spanish national teams. Torneos, Burzaco's former firm, signed a deferred prosecution agreement with the Justice Department, having replaced its entire management structure and instituted American-style governance. It agreed to forfeit almost $113 million. Conmebol broke its contract with Datisa in the wake of the indictments, freeing it to find other commercial partners to put on the Copa America Centenario. The tournament was by every measure the most successful in Copa America history, with attendance reaching almost 1.5 million, and matches televised in more than 160 countries. The 2018 World Cup, meanwhile, which Russia had fought so hard to win in 2010, drawing the unwanted attentions of former British spies and active FBI agents in the process, would proceed as planned. 8 years of one of the most intensive, ambitious, and thorough international investigations in U.S. history had profoundly shaken FIFA and its confederations, but Russia still had its World Cup. Starting in June 2018, hundreds of millions of fans would, once again, turn their attention to the field of play, where the world's 32 best teams would compete for soccer's greatest prize. It would be the first World Cup held since American law enforcement had revealed to the world the true extent of the corruption underpinning the sport, and as such, a major test of the relationship between FIFA and the sporting public. Would the soccer investigation leave a lasting impact on the sport, or would all be swiftly forgotten amid the surge of nationalistic fervor surrounding the massively popular event? Whatever the case, one thing was clear. When it came to actually playing the game of soccer, the United States had a lot to learn. On October 10th, scarcely a month before the trial began, America's national team faced Trinidad and Tobago in its final World Cup qualifier. After heavy rains, the pitch in the stadium outside of Port of Spain was completely waterlogged, and with the visiting team heavily favored, only 1,500 people showed up to watch. But an own goal by American defender Omar Gonzalez, followed by a clean strike by a Trinidad forward, proved decisive. The U.S. lost 2-1 and was eliminated from the 2018 World Cup. It was a shocking, humiliating result, the first time that the U.S. had been eliminated from the tournament since 1985, when a young Chuck Blazer was the executive vice president of the United States Soccer Federation. Tasked with international competitions and managing the national team, he witnessed the team's elimination in person, continuing what was then a 35-year stretch without qualifying for the sport's biggest event. Blazer had been on hand again 4 years later when the U.S. team in Trinidad finally cracked through and qualified for the 1990 World Cup in historic fashion. No longer at the USSF, he had the very next day gone to Jack Warner's house to launch his career as an international soccer official, and for the next 25 years, America qualified for every single World Cup. Over that time, Blazer played a key role in developing a modestly popular hobby into a legitimate, thriving, cultural and economic power in America. Whether it was vision or luck, or some statistician's insight into the fast-changing demographics of the country, the former salesman had tied himself to a rocket. Yet Blazer also proved to be one of the most tainted sports officials in American history, a pioneer not only in soccer's growth, but in its corruption. If he hadn't been taking bribes all the way back to the late 1990s, it's nearly impossible to imagine the U.S. criminal investigation ever achieving what it did. On July 12, 2017, Chuck Blazer's criminal lawyers announced that he had succumbed to the various illnesses he suffered during the final years of his life. He died still awaiting his sentence. His misconduct, for which he accepted full responsibility, should not obscure Chuck's positive impact on international soccer, Blazer's attorney Mary Mulligan wrote in a press release announcing his death. Jack Warner, Blazer's former friend and longtime partner atop CONCACAF, had not left Trinidad since returning there after his showdown with the FBI in late 2012. 3 months after he was indicted, Warner lost a parliamentary election and remained a private citizen since, fighting against his extradition. True to form, Warner greeted news of America's elimination from the World Cup with jubilation, calling it the happiest day of my life. Steve Berryman arrived in New York 6 weeks before the trial was to begin and checked into a hotel downtown. Displaying the exhaustive, detail-oriented habits that defined his work, the IRS agent assisted NHTSA and the other prosecutors prepare potential witnesses, many of whom never ended up testifying. He spent countless hours reviewing evidence in the case, rereading thousands of his own emails, and running through Excel spreadsheets until he felt he could remember every cell. Compared to the immense amount of work the prosecutors had to deal with, including dozens of motions and endless disputes with defense attorneys over evidence, Berryman's share didn't seem like too much. But he was committed to being as helpful as possible. Once the trial began, he sat alongside the prosecutors at their long table in the courtroom, cannily studying the defense attorneys and scrutinizing each witness, serving as an extra pair of eyes on the team. From the first moment he'd met him in July 2015, Berryman felt certain Alejandro Burzaco would make a great trial witness if it ever got to that point. He was smart, passionate about soccer, and spoke excellent English. Most of all, Burzaco was precise, which made him credible. He thought before he talked, and he was devastating to defense attorneys on cross-examination, never giving them a millimeter to work with, while somehow managing to appear sympathetic to the jury. There were only a few times in his career that Berryman had ever met a better natural witness. Jose Avila was another matter. 4 years, 6 months, and 25 days after he was arrested in Miami, Jose Avila took the stand. It was the 13th day of the trial, December 4th. He wore a scraggly beard, and his lung condition had progressed substantially, forcing him to carry an oxygen tank with him to the stand. Although he had seemed sharp and ready in prep sessions leading up to trial, his demeanor changed in the witness box. His testimony was critical, because he had made many of the recordings that would help incriminate the defendants and reinforce the narrative that FIFA and its confederations had been co-opted by criminals who ran them for illicit personal profit. Standing at a lectern near the jury, Nitza asked Avila to tell his life story, and then played tapes of him chatting with soccer officials and business partners over leisurely meals, calling old friends on the phone, and confiding with employees about the business. "Where did this meeting take place?" Nitza would ask. "Who is this person talking?" But as the morning progressed, Avila's pauses grew longer and his answers more vague. When Nitza asked him about the total value of the bribes he and his partners had agreed to pay for the Copa America, he paused. "I am not sure. I'm confused. I don't know what you're referring to," Avila said through his translator. It was worse on cross-examination. The defense attorneys had reviewed Avila's case file and knew about his obstruction, how a lie had gotten him busted in the first place, and how he had continued to lie even while cooperating. They portrayed him as deceptive and untrustworthy, someone who had secretly recorded and betrayed his closest friends. He had even, they noted, been dishonest to the FBI. "You sat across the table from them and you lied to them?" a lawyer defending Jose Maria Marin indignantly asked Avila. "Yes," Avila quietly responded. Despite his obvious problems, Avila had been an essential part of the case, the man who had doled out more bribes for longer than anyone else in all of North or South America, and whose extensive book of business in both regions reinforced the jurisdiction the case needed. From the prosecution's point of view, he and Burzaco were nearly identical, professional bribe payers who became cooperators only after their backs were up against the wall. But to a jury, the two men couldn't appear more different. Burzaco emerged from his 4 days of testimony bathed in virtue, a selfless man who voluntarily turned himself in because he wanted to clean up the sport he loved. Avila, meanwhile, was out only for himself, a person who would say or do anything to save his own neck. Even his apologies, which he repeated numerous times during 2 days on the stand, rang hollow. "It was a mistake," he said. "We shouldn't have paid. I regret it very much." Jurors heard from a long list of witnesses, but as the case progressed, Nitza, confident things were moving along smoothly, began culling names. It was a calculated risk. Too few witnesses and the case seems thin and unconvincing, but hammering a point too forcefully can make a prosecutor seem like a bully. After almost 4 weeks of testimony, and with Christmas fast approaching, the jury was showing signs of fatigue. One juror, in fact, had been sound asleep so often that the judge struck him from the case, bringing in an alternate. There was, however, one final witness Nitza had no plans on crossing off his list. Steve Berryman took the stand a few minutes after noon on December 7th, beginning 3 days of testimony that went to the very heart of the entire case. As Nitza manned an overhead projector, Berryman marched through a series of wire transfer receipts, spreadsheets, statements from banks in a dozen different countries, deposit slips, payment orders, emails, photographs, FedWire and CHIPS correspondent bank records, hotel receipts and airline records, meticulously tracing the trail of money, and often the parallel movements of defendants to pick up bribes paid in cash. in a dramatic crescendo. Berryman showed how Avila wired $5 million of his share of the Copa America bribes from a bank in Miami to a Swiss account controlled by Burzacco in June 2013. How just a few weeks later, $3 million was sent from the same Swiss account to an account in Andorra, where it was transferred to a second account at the same bank. And, beginning just a week later, how half of the $3 million was sent from the Andorran account, in three equal installments, to an account at Morgan Stanley in the United States. That last account, NHTSA proved by displaying to the jury a copy of the signed signature card from Morgan Stanley, belonging to Josie Maria Marin, who had been promised half of the $3 million going to Brazil's soccer leadership for Copa America bribes. Putting a cherry on top, Berryman and NHTSA, working as a tag team, then revealed how Marin had spent $118,220.49 from that same account on luxury items at high-end stores in New York, Las Vegas, and Paris in a single month. It was devastating testimony, virtually impossible to rebut. Marin's lawyers fumed that the prosecution had embarrassed their client by revealing his spending habits, including the fact that he had spent $50,000 in just one transaction at upscale retailer Bulgari. But privately, they marveled at how effective the IRS agent had been on the stand. The entire case could never have come together without his diligent work. They all agreed. When Berryman finally stepped down on December 12th, the prosecution rested. Later that day, one of the defense attorneys tracked the agent down and, breaking with protocol, gave him a hug. "You did a great job, Steve," the attorney said. "I just wanted you to know that." On December 15th, deliberations began. The jurors' instructions, read by Judge Chen, ran 54 pages long. She cautioned them about the complicated RICO, wire fraud, and money laundering statutes they had to consider. The defense, throughout the trial and in its closing arguments, had never argued soccer wasn't corrupt. In fact, they had frequently complimented the prosecution for the work it had done to scour the sport of decades of self-dealing. Their argument instead was that although other officials had clearly taken bribes, their clients had not. The investigation, they said, had overreached and accused innocent men. In his closing argument, prosecutor Sam NHTSA scoffed at the idea that everyone except them accepted bribes. The decision facing the jurors, he said, was an easy one. "There are mysteries to be solved, there are whodunits," said NHTSA, visibly exhausted after the strain of 6 weeks of trial and the months of preparation leading up to it. "This isn't one of them. Some things," he added, "are just the way they appear." A week later, Josie Maria Marin and Juan Angel Naput were convicted on 9 of 12 counts against them, including the critical RICO charges. Naput faced a maximum sentence of 60 years in prison. Marin, 120. NHTSA asked the judge to send them directly to jail rather than await their sentences under house arrest, as is common in white-collar cases. Given their wealth and foreign citizenship, he argued, the risk of flight is at its zenith. Judge Chen, noting she would likely impose very significant sentences, agreed. Naput, whose entire family had sat in the courtroom throughout the trial, turned to his wife and grimly handed her his watch, wedding ring, a chain from around his neck, and his belt, before marshals took him and Marin into custody. The two South American soccer officials would spend Christmas in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. Then on December 26th, the jury returned one last verdict, pronouncing Manuel Berga not guilty of RICO conspiracy, the lone count against him. Berga, tall and laconic, had spent his free hours during the lengthy trial and deliberation reading historical fiction novels, and doing puzzles in a magazine called Super Mata Tiempo, Super Time Killer. While Naput and Marin had large trial teams with multiple lawyers arguing their case, Berga had just one attorney, a harried former prosecutor from Fort Lauderdale, who complained repeatedly to the judge that he didn't have enough time to do everything. Berga had been extradited from Peru a year earlier on condition that the U.S. prosecute him only for the RICO conspiracy count. Peru was conducting its own investigation of Berga for fraud and money laundering, and didn't want to see the man charged twice for the same crimes. Perhaps, the prosecutors theorized after the verdict, it was because he had only one count against him that the jury ruled as it did. Compared to Naput and Marin, with all their complicated charges, perhaps Berga seemed small time. It could have been alternatively because the theory of his corruption was more complicated, that because he knew of the Peruvian investigation, he chose not to actually receive the bribes he negotiated, planning to take them later. Maybe the jurors, after 7 weeks, were just exhausted and wanted to go home. Whatever the reason, the acquittal stung, and Nitze, Mace, and Edelman found it hard not to wonder what had gone wrong. The guilty verdicts against Naput and Marin had been a huge relief, upholding the premise of the entire investigation, that soccer itself had been tarnished, and that its officials knowingly defrauded the institutions they were supposed to serve. Berga, they were certain, was no different. But he had walked nonetheless. Berryman heard about the verdicts at home in Southern California. He had flown back on December 21st, eager to be with his family after 3 grueling months in New York. Over the course of his career, Berryman had sat through 8 other trials and had never once missed a verdict. But the holidays were approaching and he desperately needed a rest. Among the prosecutors, used to winning nearly 100% of the time, there was second-guessing. But Berryman refused to speculate. After sitting through so many trials in his career, he knew juries were impossible to predict. He was satisfied he'd done his job. December 26th, the day Berga's verdict was read, is Boxing Day, traditionally a huge day for soccer in England. There were 8 different premiership matches played, all of them televised in the United States. For Steve Berryman, it turned out to be a good day. His beloved Liverpool spanked Swansea City 5-0. Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal, was written by Ken Bensinger and read by Jonathan Todd Ross. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Falley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal, is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.